House Revenue Committee will come to order, and we have some related bills today, so we're going to open a public hearing on the first three of our bills, public hearing on House Bill 2030, House Bill 2031, and House Bill 2032. We'll open that public hearing, and we'll hear first from Diane Belt. Thank you very much for coming.
Glad to be here.
And I think it's afternoon, but we'll take that.
Well, I think you're right. It's been a little bit hectic last week or so.
I'll bet.
I feel like I'm still on Tuesday of last week.
If you would identify yourself for the committee and for the record, and then proceed with your testimony, we'd appreciate it.
Sure. My name is Diane Belt, and I am the legislative representative for the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I'm also the tax collection supervisor for Washington County. And with me today is also Bob Vroman, who is the tax collection manager for Clackamas County.
Thank you.
Okay. Did you want to start with the House Bill 2030 then, or?
My understanding was that you were going to do an overview of the bills, and then you can talk about them in whatever order you want,
I thought I was supposed to do a little overview about tax collections in general.
I think that would be a great place to start, since all these bills are related to that issue.
Okay. Typically, there are four types of property taxes in the state of Oregon, and they are real property, personal property, utilities, and manufactured structures. So we kind of consider those each their own separate tax roll. I've done a few things for you, hopefully to help a little bit, some written testimony and a flow chart and actually a copy of a tax statement, and I have to apologize because the person that ran it forgot to put in 1115, so it is showing interest, but we don't send them out that way, just so you know. A copy of a distribution schedule that we use, and also a little chart about the life of a tax roll and how the collections come in. But once the values in the county are certified, then we begin what we call our rate calculation, and this typically begins in August and September. And that's how we determine the millage rate that is used to actually multiply times the value to equal the tax. In order to know what kind of tax dollars that we need to raise, we receive from all of the taxing districts in July a form that certifies any bonds that they have passed, any special levies that they may have passed and are collecting on, and they also kind of remind us of their permanent rate that they've been assigned, so that when we get that information, we know exactly what kind of money that they're planning to raise. So we take all of that information and we put our values, and just to make a long story short, that's how we come up with the tax. There's a lot of other things that go into that, compression, urban renewal, but if you had 3 days, we could talk about that, so we'll pass. So once our tax roll is actually created, then we take and produce what is called a percentage distribution, so that each district gets a percentage of their share of the pot. So it's like you put all the taxes in a bucket, and then according to the amount that they have levied, then we determine how much of what we collect they get. And as the taxes start to come in, then we take those amounts and we apply it towards that percentage, which I gave you a copy of Washington County's, and then we do what is called a turnover. So during the months of October and November, those turnovers happen weekly so that the districts get their money as soon as possible, because that is our heavy collection period. On the last form, it actually shows that within that between October 15th and November 15th, we collect 85% of the tax. So the majority of the tax comes in very quick and very early. By the end of the fiscal year, which is June 30th, we are typically about 96 to 97% collected. So the money comes in, and we distribute it just as soon as we get it to the districts. When the bills go out, they have to be in the mail by the 25th of October. The due date is November the 15th if a person wants to take advantage of a 3% discount. They also have an option of paying the first two-thirds, and they would receive a 2% discount, and the last third would be due May 15th, or they can elect to make three equal payments of November, February, May 15th. There's no interest, but there's no discount. Then in June, we send out a delinquent notice to every person on the tax roll that still has an amount owing, and we do that every every year in June to kind of give people a reminder of what's still out there. We also handle the bankruptcies for the county. We do a judicial foreclosure when the properties are 3 years delinquent. And we also do all of the personal property tax collections. So there's a lot of things that go on once that tax is certified, and we kind of keep track of it, the ins and the outs, and how much interest and how much discount, and we do report to the state yearly on our collections. Bob, did I miss anything?
Diane's been pretty thorough. I think we could
Excuse me. Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Certainly, Chairman Barnhart. My name is Bob Vroman. I'm the Assessment and Tax Manager at Clackamas County, and I'm here along with Diane representing the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors.
Great. Thank you. Go ahead and add your comments.
You're welcome. I was just going to say, I think Diane was very thorough in what we do. I think something that's very important is in the 2005-2006 year, property taxes that were billed in Oregon were $3.9 billion. So we go through this process on an annual basis, and I think key things here are that we try to do it, of course, very efficiently, and we're collecting a very high percentage of that money by our November 15th collection date, and we're collecting almost all of each annual levy by the end of the tax year.
And Mr. Chair, committee members, if you're down in your local county, Washington County, this is our summary. Some counties are very lucky and they get to do it on an 8.5 by 11. But Washington County, and I'm sure Clackamas, we produce this booklet every year that shows. It really has an awful lot of information. Ours happens to be online. I'm sure other counties are as well. But if you ever kind of want to look at what's happening with your property tax, go to your county assessor or tax collector right after the tax rolls have been mailed, and you can receive this. And it has a breakdown of districts and their rates and their funding. It also has all the different tax rates for each district. So it really kind of gives you an idea of what's going on in your county. And the taxpayer, when they get their tax bill, another thing that we started doing several years ago, if you look at the one side of the tax bill, it actually shows the taxpayer what districts they're paying into. And we separate it out into three districts, which would be the education total, because there is the Measure 5 $5 limit, and the government total, which the limit is $10, and then unlimited would be your bonds, special assessments, things that can't be limited. So when the tax bills come out, there really is a wealth of information for a taxpayer to look to see exactly where their property taxes are going.
Thank you. Are there questions on the overview at this point? Thank you. Yes, sir. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had one question, Diane, and I'd probably send you back to hunt this up for us, if you would, please. Bob mentioned that there's total about $3.9 billion billed for property taxes each year, and your indication was that somewhere 96% to 97% of that is all collected by the end. I just wondered what the total amount, dollar amount, of the 3% and 2% discounts amounted to. Do we know that number statewide?
I mean statewide?
Statewide.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. The Department of Revenue would have that information,
okay,
because it is reported. In looking at the last sheet that I had, the total discount that was allowed for the 2000 tax year, and the reason I picked that one is because we just foreclosed on it, was $87,000, and that was in Washington County. So I'm sure if the Department of Revenue doesn't have their fingers on it very quickly, because we do make that report, I can get a call, and I could definitely get you that amount.
I think I see, Mr. Chair, that John may have that number. So I just would like to know how much that amounts to in discounts that are offered for early pay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Anything else on this? I think we're going to allow our committee administrator then to summarize give us the summaries on the bills that we're hearing, and then we'll go to the testimony on the bills.
Okay.
You ready?
Yes.
Okay.
The first bill, House Bill 2030, repeals a sunset date, July 1, 2008, that is prescribed for Section 4 of Chapter 190 Oregon Laws 2003. And that Section 4 authorized the creation of what's called a bankruptcy account that tax collectors can use in order to cover the cost of collecting taxes on bankruptcies. the balance that is collected in the bankruptcy account has to be transferred on June 30th to an unsegregated account for distribution to local taxing authorities. Okay. Right now, if basically this will repeal the sunset date and continue to allow the tax collectors to have this access to funds to help them cover their costs in collecting these fees. The H Bill 2031 pertains to the ability of the tax collector to petition the court to cancel uncollected deferral amounts on exempt real property. When, under current law, when a property that is specially assessed, okay, is disqualified, say a farm or a forest land property that is disqualified for one reason or another, the deferred taxes are due for a certain number of years, not to exceed the number of years the property was granted that special assessment. Some of these deferred taxes are uncollectible, however, if the property is transferred or sold to some entity that is tax exempt, say a local government. Mm-hmm. When this occurs under current law, the taxes remain on the books as uncollected taxes that are due. What the collectors are asking for is the petition to cancel those deferred amounts because they'll never be collected.
I just had a question of staff, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So those are left on the county books as in effect the loss of the loss of the deferral, and they would show as a liability against whom? Against the, I guess it'd still be against the property?
Against the property as a delinquent tax, but they'll never be paid by the exempt new owners.
Okay, and so how long do those stay on county books?
Forever.
1968 is the oldest one, I think.
Okay, so this does provide then for an actual cancellation of it then?
That is correct.
Okay.
Vice Chair Butler.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
House Bill 2032 will allow the Department of Revenue to pay delinquent taxes, interest, and penalties on homestead property for which a property tax deferral is claimed by qualified seniors or disabled persons who initially claim the deferral on or after January 1, 2008. Currently, we have a senior and disabled property tax deferral program for owners of property. They may defer their taxes if they're eligible and meet certain qualifications for income. But when they apply and get this deferral, they may have some taxes that are due at that point in time. And there's nothing on the books right now that says that these taxes have to be paid. So they sit there as a taxes owed. And what the collectors are asking for is that the department be allowed to pay those delinquencies. And there is a potential revenue impact associated with this in the sense that when the Department of Revenue pays those taxes, there's obviously a loss of, let's say, revenue because they're paying that. But there's also an offset in the sense that the state obtains interest on those deferrals. And the current program right now might show you that there's always a trade-off there. And the interest accrues so that it's not necessarily a negative impact. It's a deferral with some transitional changes.
So, Mr. Chair, just by thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification then, if a citizen, a homeowner citizen qualifying for the deferral, with property that would qualify for the deferral, had delinquent taxes at the time they signed up for the deferral, then from that point forward, the Department of Revenue uses that senior deferral resource to pay the property taxes currently. It does not pay any of the arrears.
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Vice Chair.
So this bill then would, just by further clarification, Mr. Chair, this bill then would allow the Department of Revenue, or would require the Department of Revenue then to pick up that portion which was delinquent at the time the property went into the homestead deferral.
That is correct,
Representative. Okay. Presently, those amounts which were delinquent at that time what happens to them? Because that could be for 20 years.
They stay on the books as delinquent taxes, but there's a provision, I believe, so that you can't foreclose or anything like that.
They couldn't foreclose against the state. But are they drawing interest? Are they accumulating interest?
I think we'll hear from that on during the testimony.
Okay. All questions will be answered.
All those questions will be answered.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. Are there other questions of the administrator? All right. You're also signed up for these bills. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record again, my name is Diane Belk. I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, and I'm also the tax collection supervisor for Washington County. And we haven't been around for a session, so it's kind of nice to get reintroduced to what's a very new committee. Of course, property taxes are my favorite thing and have been for 29 years. So, what House Bill 2030, and I find it interesting that in 2003 when the legislature passed our bankruptcy bill, it was also House Bill 2030, so it's karma. I've decided that it's karma. Back in 2003, it became very clear that the county is responsible to collect the property taxes. And when a property goes into bankruptcy, it's a whole new ballgame. And it was becoming extremely difficult for us to collect these funds when you had large companies like Enron that were filing a large bankruptcy, and they typically were in Delaware or New York. Our legal counsels that represent our counties typically can only practice law in the state of Oregon, and bankruptcy is not number one on their list. So unfortunately, what was happening is the counties were having to, because we couldn't defend our tax lien in bankruptcy court, we were losing large sums of money. So we came to the legislature and asked if it was possible for us to go ahead and take some of the funds that we collected through bankruptcy to put into a special account to help pay for our legal fees in collecting these bankruptcy amounts. And the legislature very kindly said, go for it. So we did. And I have to tell you that it has been extremely successful. In my testimony, I had five counties that reported their collections over the last 3 years of about $6.1 million that we collected through bankruptcy. And our attorney fees that were spent to collect that were $241,000. Those were funds that may have been lost had we not been able to go after that money in a court outside the state of Oregon. So what we're asking is to remove the sunset so that we can keep the account going, because it's there if you need it. If you don't, you don't have to use it. Some of the smaller counties that just got hit with a couple of large bankruptcy filings, they were able to get the funds. And in the smaller counties, that's a big thing right now.
Chairman Barnhart, for the record, my name is Bob Vroman. I'm the Assessment and Tax Manager at Clackamas County, and I'm here representing the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. One thing that I would add was that when this legislation was put together back in 2003, it was very carefully crafted with the agreement from other taxing districts, which may in fact be giving up some of their money as a result of this, in order to be able to pursue collection of significant sums of money that we might not have been able to do. And the legislature at that time looked very favorably upon this, as did all of the stakeholders that were involved. And as Diane mentioned, it has been, I think, very successful in those situations where we do need to take advantage of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olson.
I'm just curious, Diane. What's your success rate for, going after and pursuing that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Olson, one that comes to mind right now is the Kmart bankruptcy. We were able to get 80% of that personal property tax, where most other states and counties got nothing. In the Enron case, we were able to negotiate, and it was a very large sum of money that the counties were, and it wasn't just our county, it was a lot of counties, and we were able to negotiate, I believe it was 85 to 90% of what was due to us, and some counties got nothing. So it was then that we realized that this is a very important tool. And it also, what we have found in doing this, because a lot of these cases are filed in Delaware, and I've been told it's because the state is a little more, they like corporations there, and they take care of them, and that's why they file. And what it does when you have four or five counties from the state of Oregon going in right off the shot and saying you're not doing anything until you take care of these taxes, it lets them know that we're very serious about it, and it's helped us in other subsequent cases that have been filed. But I have, in some cases, I've gotten it all. It just kind of depends upon the type of a case and what's happening. The Kmart, they actually kind of reorganized and got back on their feet. Of course, Enron did not. And then it depends upon the type of property. In the Enron case, it was, you know, communication property that was devaluing faster than it was going downhill in a hurry. So we were very fortunate to get what we got.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Remind me the process of this whole thing. You set up a bankruptcy, a special fund for bankruptcy collections. There it is, property tax bankruptcy. What's the source of funds for that account?
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger. We take the tax that's collected through the order of a bankruptcy court, so we're only taking taxes that are being paid, like a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, which would be a consumer reorganization. The tax that is collected on those payments go into that fund, or a Chapter 11, which is a corporation reorganization, any kind of payments that come in. So we're just taking funds from actual amounts that have been ordered by a bankruptcy court.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Can I continue what I'm trying to get at? And then that is used as for attorney fees to pay to go after other bankruptcy money that you wouldn't actually. Am I correct? Have I got the mechanism right? I'm just, this is a reality check.
Yes.
I'm getting to a question, Mr. Chair.
let's just, to clarify that, you're paying the bankruptcy attorney who represents you out of the collections that you receive for processing bankruptcies.
That's correct.
Thank you. Go ahead.
That's what I wanted to get in my mind, my hand around. And then my question is, do you know of any counties that are in deficit in this account? In other words, who are unable to fund an attorney because there isn't enough money, or are all counties just doing swimmingly on this? I mean, your examples are stunning, okay, but that doesn't mean that five counties are doing great and the rest, there's 36 counties. So give us a...
Sure, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger. They're probably, not all 36 counties are taking advantage of it, because not all 36 counties have some of these larger cases, like maybe Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas would have. But I know Hood River, they took advantage of it 1 year because they did have a large case that they were trying to collect their funds. I think it was well over $1 million in tax, so it was to their advantage to do so, and they only did it 1 year. Washington County, we have a pretty large bankruptcy load, so yes, we do take advantage of that. If it ever comes to a point that bankruptcies go away, no, we won't, but I don't think that's going to happen. But it's a county by county. If a county legal counsel feels that it's something that they can handle, they are not going to take advantage of it. But if it's something that's outside their expertise, or if the dollar amount really warrants the fact that they need to go after this, then they will take advantage of it.
I guess my question is, have there been incidences where they spent the legal fees and didn't get the award? You see the danger, the downside danger?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that's always a chance you take.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't heard that ever happening, however.
That's the fundamental question I'm getting in.
Yeah, there's always a chance. I mean, any bankruptcy can go sour. That's just a chance that you take. But if you don't try to get it, you're not going to get it. And that's just been our experience because the federal bankruptcy laws supersede any of our state statutes, so it becomes extremely difficult. And at times we've even had to argue over the interest rate because they've tried to make us take a lesser interest rate than we're entitled to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I have one, I think. In many situations, the bankruptcy law inserts state law in its consideration of a variety of issues. Is that true in this area, as in the area of Texas as well?
Mr. Chair, when they had the bankruptcy reform in October, that was very beneficial to us as counties because too many times, especially when it came to the interest rate or the priority that we were going to, how we were going to get paid in the food chain, we should be up at the top, but a lot of times we were getting put way down at the bottom and we were having to you know, fight for that, even though our statute says that our lien is superior. With the bankruptcy reform, they have addressed those issues, and in Chapter 13 cases, we are in a much better position now because they do recognize state statute, where prior to that, they didn't. And you usually, especially if it was out of state, you usually ended up trying to argue with the attorneys over, you know, what takes precedence, state law or federal law, and most of the times, we didn't win.
Okay, so now the federal law, if I understand, the federal law now says you look to the state law for this, priority issue, and,
yes.
And our state law says that you have a superior position.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It's made things a lot easier, but our biggest problem with some of these large Chapter 11s is that they're out of state, and our attorneys can't practice out of state.
Right. If mm-hmm. there's a corporation that's incorporated in Delaware, and they file in Delaware, you have to hire a Delaware attorney.
Yes.
To represent, and one presumes, that this wasn't asked, and I'm not sure you actually said this, but I'm assuming that when we're dealing with these large corporations that have property in a number of different counties, you would go together, as it were, hire counsel to represent all of you at one swoop.
Yeah.
For the purpose of collecting these back taxes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's exactly what we did in Kmart and Enron, and it was very effective.
Great. Has that generated other questions for people? All right. I think what we're going to do is hear from you on the rest of the bills, and then for those who are in the audience but who didn't sign up but still want to be heard, we'll take them afterwards on each of them. Go ahead.
House Bill 2031 deals with an issue that, and I gave you kind of a little spreadsheet to kind of give you an idea. When you have a piece of property that, let's say you have a city that comes in and they're going to build their fire hall, and there was a farm deferral on that property, once it went into exempt status, then the deferral got disqualified, and because they're exempt, they're not required to pay that tax, so it sits out there forever. Unless they sell the property or the use of the land changes. And I was surprised, I didn't realize it went quite that far back, but we have some counties that have taxes clear back to 1968. So we have to carry those forward every year. We have to report them every year. And in essence, they are uncollectible. We are not going to get those taxes. So what the tax collectors would like is to amend our statute 311-790 that gives us the authority to cancel taxes that are personal property when we deem that they're wholly uncollectible, and incorporate any kind of special assessment that has been canceled on properties that are exempt. The laws changed in early 2000. We don't see this situation happening that much anymore, so a lot of this is just stuff that's going to hang out there forever, and we would sure like to clean our books up.
Questions? I have a couple. What were the law changes in 2000 that affected this situation?
It had, Mr. Chair, it had to do with the fact that that the lien attaches the day prior to the sale. So it gave us more of an opportunity to get in and collect that deferred tax before the process actually happens.
But we collected it in closing?
Yes.
After, for sales after that?
Yes.
So we're only talking about old stuff.
It's pretty, yeah.
Hanging in from ancient days.
Yes.
All right. In the bill, and I may need to ask somebody else this question. In the bill, it refers to the county court. Does that mean the county commissioners?
Mr. Chair, yes, it does. I've been told, because I always question that, but I was told by our legal counsel that that's one and the same.
Well, and of course, I wanted to make certain of that.
Yes.
Only one county still has a county court, I believe.
Yes.
In Oregon.
Is that Harlan County?
All the others have county commissions now that fulfill
right.
many of the same functions.
Right.
All right.
But that's the way the bill has always been written, and I've been told that those are the same.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just a quick clarification, and I've got a question. There's more that have county courts than just one.
Oh, are there? Okay.
They're
small counties.
Very small counties.
Many that you represent.
with regard to this, and help me here, Diane, with regard to this tax attaching the day before the change from the deferred use, so if a property was in deferred in a deferral status and was to be donated to a school, for instance, for a new school facility, then at the day before the deed is actually recorded, then the taxes are assessed that day.
Mr. Chair, yeah, Representative Butler, Bob, you may have to help me on this one because he does more assessment than I do, I think. The assessor can disqualify that deferral and put it on the tax roll as due and payable. What they do now, rather than if the assessor would come by and say that, you know, this isn't meeting qualifications for farm deferral, so I'm going to disqualify it. It used to be that the next year the taxpayer would get this bill for $25,000, you know, and they'd go, oh, my gosh. Then they'd run right down to the assessor, and they'd reapply, and then we'd undo it. So the assessors had the laws changed so that if they disqualify it, in their estimation, it's not meeting the qualifications, and it shows as a lien on the property. It's not actually extended to the tax roll. It just shows as a lien on the property. And I believe that's when a lot of these problems stopped, when they started doing that.
I just have a follow-up.
Follow-up, yes.
The mechanics of it are beyond me, but I just want to make sure that if you have property donated to a public school, that we're not going to come back, and first of all, we're not going to stop that donation.
Oh, no.
And number two, that you're not going to come back to the school and say, wait a minute, this was forest property the day before yesterday, but today you now fully intend to build a school on it. You owe us $25,000 for the deferred value. Is that what's happening here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's not what's happening.
Okay.
And it hasn't been since about 2000.
Okay, so we're not changing the fact that those deferred special use properties, that we're accelerating that somehow so that the new municipality or school district or nonprofit organization would owe that just as a result of the fact that it was a donation.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's the problem we had back in the 60s. And when they became exempt, they weren't required to pay.
Okay, all right.
And so that doesn't happen now. So
this clears off that old one.
We're just trying to clean that mess up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. I'm glad somebody's paying attention to the books. Bob, did you have some things to add?
No, Chairman Barnard, no, I was going to say that's absolutely correct. What this does will allow us to make sure that our records, in a lot of ways, are a lot more reflective of what's actually owing out there. A lot of times taxing districts will look to see, you know, what they may be entitled to collect. And in some cases, these are never going to be collectible. And it would be that way in the case that Vice Chair Butler described, where a school may have purchased or acquired a piece of property that had some deferred taxes that were never satisfied. They would remain on the books. It's going to be a school. They're never going to be collected. And this would allow us that opportunity to make sure that our records are more reflective of what's actually out there.
Thank you. So this comes under the streamlining accountability and transparency agendas, as it were.
Yes.
We don't want people in the taxing district to think that the district is owed money that it isn't owed.
That's
and
exactly.
And it is never going to receive.
And Mr. Chair, my clerk that handles the audit before she retires would like to see these go away. Because she's every year we got to pull them over.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I would only add that when you convert to a different system, if you ever do that, you would really want these to not be there. Because they're one of those things that then you have to go many times a lot of years back to keep track of that you wouldn't normally have to.
Thank you. Other questions on House Bill 2031? Let's go to House Bill 2032.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2032 evidently got a lot of attention. And I need to tell you up front that there are some issues with this bill, and we do need to propose some amendments. But I would like to kind of at least explain to the committee what we're attempting to do. In the 60s, in my testimony, I said 70s, and I guess it was about 1963, we developed what is called the Senior Deferral Program, and what that did was allowed folks that reached a certain age and income limit to apply to have the state of Oregon pay their property taxes. Through the years, the program has been fairly streamlined to the point that there was an income limit that was established, which never used to be there. It has since been retooled so that it increments along with the economy at 3%. And also, a couple sessions ago, we added for the folks that have disabilities that would qualify to also be on the program. Well, the way it works at this point in time is a person who does qualify comes into the county assessor between January 1 and April the 15th of each year to make application for the deferral. And all they have to do is meet the income requirement and be owner of the property. So the county accepts those applications, and then we forward them on to the state of Oregon. And the state of Oregon has several things that they do with it. And then come the next November, they will pay that person's property tax, and the debt then stays with the state of Oregon, and their interest rate is a simple 6%. Well, what happens and has been happening is when a person comes in to make application, if they have delinquent taxes at the time of application, they're not paid. They only start paying prospectively, so the next year they will start paying. So we've talked about this for several years, but it just have never quite gone very far with it. The bill, the way it's written, I think is a little confusing, because our intent is to start this program with the January 8th application period, and at the time that somebody would come in to apply, if they had back taxes, then the state would pick those up. We're not asking to go back and pick up the $5 million that are out there right now, because eventually those will either get paid or they will become uncollectible. Some of them do go back to the 80s, so I'm sure that the value of the property isn't going to be sufficient to pay the debt to the state as well as the taxes. So I suspect that as these start to clear out, some of those will probably be uncollectible because the value just won't be there. But what we're wanting to accomplish with this bill is to start anew, so that at the time of application from one point forward, if there's any delinquent taxes, the state would pick them up at that time and make that become part of the tax lien with the state. Typically, when we look at the applications, speaking with the Department of Revenue, we probably statewide have about 1,100 applicants yearly. My guess, and I am going to get those numbers when we come back to you, that a very small majority of those actually do have a delinquent tax, but there are some. And so that is our intent with this bill. And we definitely need some amendments to make it work the way that we've talked about. And I do know that there are some other folks that have some issues with the way the bill is written. And hopefully we can sit down with those folks as well. And once we put the numbers together, I think that we'll see that we're not talking about a real huge sum of money.
Okay. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Diane, you're telling us today, that you're telling the committee today, that you're comfortable that with regard to 2032, those issues with that due or past due pre-deferral of the property taxes on those qualifying seniors, that you can get those folks together in some sort of a work group and come back to this committee with the necessary amendments that everybody's got a frown on their face today. We'll have a smiley face, and we'll look across the dais and see all smiley faces substantially.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, I am.
My kind of person. Thank you.
That's great. Other questions for this panel on these bills? Yeah, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of reserving final sort of question or opinion here until I find out, you know, who the frowning faces are and what what the smiley faces are going to be, but I'm still not clear in my mind why this is such a desirable thing to do. I mean, is it just is it cleaning up your books?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, part of it is keeping, you know, the tax bill current, but also part of it, I truly believe, it's a good thing for the senior. Our interest rate is 16%. The state charges 6% simple interest. It's very confusing for these folks when they get a notice from the state of Oregon that says they've paid their taxes, then they get a notice from the county that says, oh, by the way, you still owe these delinquent taxes. Most folks were under the impression at the time they applied that this was all going to be taken care of, and then it was one total program. So our desire for several years has been to make it one total program so that the senior actually is dealing with the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, that begs another question then. So if this gets, and I haven't seen the amendments and don't quite understand what those will look like, but so what they'll get then is not two notices, one from you for 16% and the state for a simple, what did you say, six?
Six.
They'll just get one for six.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes. They'll just get one notice from the state of Oregon.
Okay. Thank you. That does explain why they'd want to do this. Okay.
Makes some sense. Yeah. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate your testimony. We'll look forward to seeing your proposed amendment on House Bill 2032.
Thank you.
Thank
Mr.
you very
Chair,
much.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Craney, thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there others who would like to be heard on these any of these three bills? Someone in the back with a hand up. All right. Go ahead and come forward. They're not on my list. They'll have to identify themselves. Oh, yeah, here they are. I'm wrong. I have three lists, and it was buried on the bottom one. Let me see here. Jim Davis,
sure.
Nicole Palmater,
Palmater,
and is it Rick Bennett?
Could be, yes.
Okay. Great. And you want to talk about House Bill 2032.
We do want to.
I apologize. I have three sign-up sheets here. The first two had just those two names on it, and I didn't look at the third one.
No problem.
Go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nicole Palmater with O4AD, the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, representing seniors and people with physical disabilities within the state. We are here to talk about House Bill 2032, and in the last session, we had a really great bill passed, Senate Bill 870, and that bill did a lot of things for Oregon Project Independence, probably one of the finest things that Oregon does for seniors and people with disabilities by allowing people the small amount of aid that they need to stay in their homes, to continue to be independent, to keep their dignity. What Senate Bill 870 did was allow the excess revenues from the Senior and Disabled Property Tax Deferral Program to go to Oregon Project Independence on into the future through a trust fund created by that bill. Oregon Project Independence's goal is to continue to expand the program, to grow it, to take seniors off the waiting list, and to add people with physical disabilities. And the funds from the property tax deferral would allow that program to grow and meet that goal. House Bill 2032 would put Project Independence in jeopardy once again and put Oregon seniors currently receiving services, along with seniors waiting for OPI and people with physical disabilities that are waiting to get into the program, in danger of being left out in the cold. The bill allows counties to collect back interest, tax, and penalties, just as was shared a minute ago, owed from the excesses which would normally be directed to the surplus, the project directed from that surplus into Project Independence. This sets a new precedent for taking these funds away from the program. In the first year of the bill, as it was drafted and as it was explained to us, it's estimated that $5 to $6 million could be taken out of those excess revenues and also out of Oregon Project Independence. Those funds would immediately be snatched away from Oregon seniors and people with disabilities by no longer being able to be available to Project Independence. Oregon Project Independence, again, is having problems. The governor's recommended budget does propose $16 million for...
Excuse me just a moment. On the point that you just made, the earlier panel testified that they were going to propose an amendment that would remove payments for the long past, I think, buildup
would that deal with the $5 to $6 million in the first year, or is that something different?
I believe it would deal with the first year, but we would like to see how those amendments are written.
All right. Thank you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Not at all. With the governor's recommended budget, the Oregon Project Independence is funded through the senior and disabled property tax deferral almost entirely. Therefore, that's our major concern with this bill, with the $5 to $6 million that could potentially be taken out of it. Taking $5 to $6 million from seniors and people with disabilities, though, before we can even have a discussion about the general fund commitment to this program is not a good way to do business. The counties, after the first collection of funds that's kind of being disputed here, the $5 to $6 million, would stand to gain approximately $500,000 a year from this particular collection, as it was explained to us. Divided amongst all the counties is really not a significant amount of money. However, to a senior or to a person with a disability who's hoping to stay in their home, it means everything to them. OPI is one of Oregon's finest accomplishments. It's one of the ways that we do very good business in serving our vulnerable citizens. We do look forward to working with the other stakeholders on this bill. We'd like to see a resolution, but most importantly, we'd really like to see Oregon Project Independence be able to realize the benefit of the senior property tax deferral funds and, frankly, to be left alone and let the program continue to do that in which it was intended to, serve our seniors, serve people with physical disabilities, allow them to live independently and with dignity to the very best that we can offer them. We look forward to working on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we'll finish the panel and then we'll have questions. Go ahead.
I'm Jim Davis, a psychologist and gerontologist representing a number of different groups, including the Oregon State Council for Retired Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, Gray Panthers, Advocacy Coalition for Seniors and People with Disabilities, and Save Oregon Seniors. We come to you with great opposition to the way the bill is written now and potential opposition to any form that it could be written in the future if it takes money from Oregon Project Independence. All of the groups that I'm representing now, we all took part in this wonderful effort around Senate Bill 870 last year, or last session, I should say. And this was directing this surplus into from the senior and disabled property tax deferral into OPI. And I've been with the senior disability service system from the very beginning of when it started, many decades ago, and I remember back in 1975 as an intern for the Committee on Aging how OPI was developed and its purpose, and it has been the cornerstone of our system, and it is a safety net for those who don't qualify for Medicaid, and so it's critically important. It should have a lot more money than has been figured in the governor's budget, but the fact is the governor's budget is based on a number of different funding sources, and this bill, certainly as it is written, would disrupt that to a great extent and cause potential damage to the senior service system, particularly for those near poor individuals who don't qualify for Medicaid. The statement I want to make here is I understand that the amendments are coming forth, and they seem like very nice people, and she was telling me that tax collectors are nice people too, and I'm sure that's the case. But in this particular instance, if their legislation will take any money away from Oregon Project Independence, then it's not acceptable to us, because we feel we came to an understanding with the legislature in the last session that would allow this money to be delivered to us, you know, in a bigger chunk the first year and then in a lesser chunk after that. But this is a critically important fund for us. This program is vital to our seniors and people with disabilities. So we do urge you to keep your commitment to OPI and to oppose this bill if it's going to take any money away from our programs. And I thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett?
Chairman Barnhart, for the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP Oregon. I think the other panelists have already clearly stated our concerns related to House Bill 2032. What I would add is that AARP Oregon, we've surveyed our members over the past, and I might add that we have over 485,000 50-plus members here in Oregon. that there's been very strong support for home and community-based programs, including Oregon Project Independence. And we were also supportive of Senate Bill 870 last session. And the reality, as Dr. Davis has indicated, is that program as effective and as it is, it's never been adequately funded, and we're concerned that this bill would further affect the funding of that program. And with that, I will close my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Mr. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to defer to Representative Butler to form the question better than I am trying to. I don't think you'll get any arguments here in this committee with the power of Oregon Project Independence. That's, you know, let's kind of take that off the table. And let's talk about the mechanism here of the bill from last session. It was OPI. Explain to me how the deferral account, the mechanism of how the deferral account supports OPI and what, how 5 to 6 million would disappear under this bill. It's that mechanism piece that I'm missing.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Berger, is a little confusing to me too. I have to admit I'm not a tax expert, just a taxpayer. But as it was explained through people at the Department of Revenue to me, the 5 to 6 million, again, was how the bill was originally written, that would go into looking at back penalties, back taxes, and back interest. If that's taken off the table, then that issue, I believe, would be gone, as it's been explained to me. What Senate Bill 870 did is we had looked for some different ways to try to bring a dedicated source of funding to Oregon Project Independence that wouldn't 100% rely always on the general fund. Every year when people pay back into it, they have some excesses. We saw the trend. And those funds would then kind of be directed.
It just seemed to me that this would strengthen that, not detract from it. But I hope the Department of Revenue will make this perfectly clear, and I'm looking in the back room.
We hope so, too.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Berger did a great job. I'm looking forward to hearing about the amount of resources that there are available, and then I'm looking forward to, Mr. Chair, the resolution and what it will look like in order to protect both the counties as well as Oregon Project Independence and the funds that they feel like that they've got coming to protect those folks that need that independence in their lives.
Mm-hmm. I think I can answer that question.
Go ahead.
Representative Berger, I think I can answer your question. I've looked at the...
Mary, go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Chair Barnhart. The cash flow that occurs in that deferral account has money coming in from tax from seniors who repay their finances, and then there's this cash outlay to the counties every year. If you look at the month by month balance, so to speak, it builds up over time, and every year the Department of Revenue can look at that balance and see if there's a sufficient amount there that it feels can give back to general fund and still be able to make its commitment to repay the counties what is due.
Okay.
I don't know that there's an exact amount that the Department of Revenue looks at every year to say how much can we do we want to keep in the balance, in the balance of the account, to feel that we'll have enough to repay the counties. But a year or two ago, I think they transferred $15 million to general fund, but I don't know that they can continue to do that annually, because it takes several years to build up an excess balance, so to speak.
I get it. I think I understand. Would that help me?
I think we'll hear from the department in a minute, but I have a question. I'll let other people ask theirs first. I wonder if you know what the overlap is between the two sets of people. One set of people are the people in Project Independence, and the other set of people are people who defer their taxes. It occurs to me, I mean, the question I'm thinking of is that it occurs to me that passing this bill may disadvantage, perhaps disadvantage people in one way, but benefit them in a different way.
a comment on that idea.
Well, I think you're, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Mr. Chair, I think you're right. This really seems like a bill that robs Peter to pay Paul. I mean, there might be a necessity to change the process in terms of what the counties get, but what we're saying is that we had what we thought was a fairly clear understanding that there'd be a certain amount of money going to OPI. So it is ironic that this would be a senior and disability program where you would have that situation taking place and that you could potentially have that negative. So yeah, I do see it as a bit confusing that we would take this approach. I believe in fairness, but not if it's going to take money away from our senior programs.
Others comment on that question? I'm wondering if I could get the three of you, the department, and the tax collectors, maybe meeting with a member through this committee to kind of work on this issue a bit. I'm getting some head nods in the back.
Sure. No problem.
I wonder, Representative.
Oh, go ahead.
Is that an offer?
Sure. I'll jump in on this.
I wonder if Representative Olson, perhaps Representative Witt, perhaps, might work on this. The two of them and this group, and let's see about that. We have a couple more witnesses I want to hear from, but let's at least tentatively let's think about that as an informal group to see if we can work on this, and when the amendments come back, perhaps you'll have maybe have a different thing to say at that point. We don't know at this point, but perhaps.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. I'd like to hear from Lee Gerard and Mark Overbeck. I know you're not necessarily together, but if you'd come up at the same time, that may reduce our time. We do have two other bills to hear this afternoon, so we appreciate your being brief.
Good afternoon. Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, I'm Lee Gerard, and I'm the manager of the State Unit on Aging with Seniors and People with Disabilities Division of the Department of Human Services, and I happen to be the manager that oversees Oregon Project Independence. I'm testifying regarding the potential negative impact of House Bill 2032 as currently written on Oregon Project Independence Program, and I'm also providing support for the idea of a work group to discuss the details and amendments.
Perhaps you'd like to join that work group.
I probably will be joining the work group. And just to point out that as currently written, there is the potential to directly impact the amount of funding available for Oregon Project Independence for the 07-09 biennium by between $5 to $6 million, as earlier noted. There is also the potential that the legislation would, at least to some extent, reduce future funding for Oregon Project Independence. It's important to note that the funding that would be recommended to go to pay the back taxes and any penalties and interest would be coming from the senior property tax deferral revolving account, and that at this point is the only source of funding for Oregon Project Independence in the governor's recommended budget for the 07-09 biennium. So any impact to what's available as excess revenues for that account will have an impact on Oregon Project Independence. And I would just like to close by offering myself as a resource and thanking you for letting me testify.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman and members, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Mark Overbeck, and I am with Policy Shift LLC, which is a public policy consulting firm committed to bold, innovative, and courageous public policy. You have my brief testimony in front of you. I will not bore you by reading the testimony. Let me say that I believe the idea of a work group to iron out problems with the bill as it's written is an excellent idea. I would not support the bill as currently drafted. And if I may make one other recommendation, it would be that a member of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, which was very active on Oregon Project Independence Modernization in the last legislative session, be invited to participate in the work group as well. They're a very good resource for you on senior issues, as you know.
Thank you. Other questions? I think the issue has been pretty well outlined for us, and I would say in response to your testimony, Mr. Overbeck, that it sounds as though that opinion is unanimous, that the bill isn't ready today. I think I'll leave it to the work group to decide exactly who ought to be involved in it. I'm just simply proposing it as a way of having a conversation to inform the collectors as to what kind of amendments they may want to propose. And I appreciate it very much. Mm-hmm. Is there anything further on these three bills? I'm sorry. I said we'd hear from the Department of Revenue. Why don't you come forward? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue, and I'm just here to clarify the question that was asked earlier regarding the actual mechanism. As you know, the senior deferral program is and disabled deferral is where the state pays the tax of people who qualify, and then we hold a lien prospectively from the claim date for the taxes and then a simple 6% interest. Every November, we're paying around approximately $15 million. And that changes, of course, annually. And so our concern last session with Senate Bill 870 was that we would transfer money to Project Independence, and then there would not be sufficient money to pay for the taxes that are due because we don't have control over who applies and how much their taxes are going to be. So we agreed. We worked with, toward the end on that bill with Representative Richardson, and we said, we think that if on November 15th, the balance in the account exceeds the greater of $5 million or 35% of last year's tax debt, that should provide it enough cushion in there to pay the taxes. So any November, when we look at the balance and it exceeds the greater of those two, then the following February we cut the check to OPI. So that's how that mechanism works. I believe that was the question.
Representative Berger?
And history on this, did you cut the check? When did it start and how much? I mean, it's pretty new, John.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it is very new. There was an initial provision in the bill for a transfer of, I believe it was $250,000, which we made already. Yes, confirmation. Mm. And then the actual future transfer is based on that test, the 5 million or 35% has not come up yet. So
thank you.
I wonder if, for those of us who were not on the Revenue Committee last time and were not involved in that particular conversation, if you would describe briefly how money gets into that account in the first place and how it is that the account grows.
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. The way that system works initially, going way back in general terms, is that the state, through the general fund, put in some seed money into what was called the revolving account. And that seed money was then used to pay the taxes of those qualified applicants, the seniors at that time. Eventually, as the program matured, then the senior would either sell their property, they would pass away, or they would refinance, which would generate a repayment of the advanced deferred taxes. That went back into the revolving account, and then the system continued. It came to the point where the law actually provided for the money to be pulled back from the revolving account to the state's general fund. And we started making reversions, we call them, back to the general fund, $17 million, $15 million, $27 million, quite a bit of money. And then 870 came last session, and they said, here's this money. It's coming from seniors. This program is for seniors, and I don't remember all the arguments, but there was a nexus there. And they said, why doesn't some of this money go to OPI? And so then we held the discussions, and we took no policy position on it, but we wanted to make sure that we could pay the taxes and that that it actually worked.
Okay. What, Representative Berger, go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't remember this coming to revenue last session, but there was a lot of bills, and I think it was a Ways and Means bill.
Probably was. I still don't understand, and maybe it's just that I'm a little bit slow this afternoon, how it is that that account could grow over time. I mean, do you keep the interest that's earned? The reason I ask the question that way is that it seems to me that with property values increasing, and although the property taxes are not increasing at the same rate, they do increase some, that in fact you'd have a need for more money, even with repayments, than rather than less. Could you describe how that actually works and why it is that that account is growing and has funds available to siphon off for other purposes?
Mr. Chair, my only answer could be that it's the 6% simple interest that's accruing, and then that is paid back into the account. The program manager is actually here, and if that's the wrong answer or if there's more to it, perhaps Norm Miller could assist me.
That's
the answer.
That is the answer.
It's the 6%.
So I take it then that the interest stays in the account and that the you've already paid the taxes to the county, so they're not entitled to anything. The interest and the principal come back to the account, and so it's the interest that allows the account to actually grow.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
All right. Thank you.
There is a provision in the law that says that when the department pays the tax, we get the 3% discount. And that question was raised earlier on discount, but when you pay your taxes timely, the state gets the 3%. That's passed on, of course, to the senior, because then they don't owe money that wasn't paid.
Right.
And we always try to pay by the 15th, so that works.
Right. Mary?
Yes. Mr. Chair, also in 2004 and 2005, the number of accounts that were active in the program declined because there were refinancing. So there's this bubble, if you look at the data, where seniors repaid taxes, which put more back into the balance so that you could make that transfer.
So we're dealing with people who had mortgages who were lowering their interest rates?
Right, correct.
Because the interest rate market was improving.
Correct. Or it could be a cash-back mortgage, too, where they're pulling equity out.
They're pulling money out of their property, and the bank insisted that liens be paid, and this is one of the liens. Okay. Representative Witt, did you have something?
No.
No. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Anything else? Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to commend the chair for having set up a work group, and I think that with Representatives Witt and Olson to co-chair the work group and to include as many people as there have testified today, including the folks from the governor's office that deal with these seniors issues, I think would be very important. The only concern that I have is we are on an accelerated timeline.
There's
time for them to do this work and to get back with the amendments. I just hope that maybe we could set a time, or you as the chair could meet privately with the two co-chairs and set a timeline of a couple of weeks to come back with the amendments after having had one pretty good meeting, maybe a couple of meetings with these folks, so that we can proceed. Because I think it is something that really cries out for resolution for the counties to get this off their books, and certainly to address the concerns that have been expressed with regard to the delicate balance with the OPI monies that are funding that little increment of difference there for those folks.
And Representative Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. It appears to me that Representative Butler is wanting to put pressure on both Representative Witt and I, and we accept the challenge.
Thank you, sir.
Broad, capable shoulders, Mr. Chair.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anything else on these three bills? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2030, 2031, and 2032. And get my find my agenda here. Sorry. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2230. I don't have the... Mary, would you introduce the bill for us?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. 2230 and 31 are related in that it changes the deadline for filing an application with the Department of Revenue or County with respect to damaged or destroyed property. There's a filing deadline that has to be satisfied under current law. It's August 1st. That will allow the assessor to reassess property if it's destroyed. Okay. The proposal is to extend that to the greater of the 30 days, which is August 1st of the current tax year, or 60 days following the date of the destruction or damage to the property. And both of the bills are related in that sense.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. Thank you very much. These are for the department's bills that were submitted on behalf of the governor, at the request of the governor, excuse me. And Mary is correct, they're closely related. They're very closely related in that they deal with...
Should we open a public hearing on House Bill 2231 as well? And we will do so. We now are going to have before us House Bill 2230 and House Bill 2231, and you can talk about both of them.
Would you like me to start?
Yes.
Over again?
Thank you.
My name is John Phillips with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, members of the committee. These two bills deal with almost the same issue in slightly different ways, and they are narrowly focused on certain taxpayer who sustains a significant casualty loss to their property. Their property is damaged or destroyed in such a way that the value is significantly changed. And these two bills both deal with trying to help that person work through that process, and I'll talk about them individually. We work very closely with the county assessors, and there are two assessor representatives, assessor from Marion County, and also an assessment assistant with Clackamas County here to talk about these issues. So, House Bill 2230 would allow the Department of Revenue to consider extenuating circumstances and to make recommendations to the county assessor for relief when the taxpayer sustains substantial casualty loss and that they file late. Now, what I'm talking about is that the assessment date is January 1. All property is appraised and assessed annually on January 1. The tax year starts July 1. And sometime between January and July, people have a fire and their property burns. Or there's a tornado. Or there's some situation that occurs where a substantial casualty loss occurs. And when that happens, the following November, they get a tax bill for property that doesn't exist anymore. And that's like adding insult to injury. So there's a process in the law where they can apply to have their property valued as of July 1, not January 1, to reflect any of the changes that occurred to it during that period of time. It's the only situation where property value is determined as of July 1. So these people are allowed that deference. They can file for that. If it occurs in January, they can file all the way to the end of the year. If it occurs in June, they only have until August 1. And so if they miss that filing deadline, then the department cannot hear a case where they're asking for a late filing to be granted because of a hardship situation. The department does have authority to hear hardship situation claims for late filing for a filing for exemption. Let's say you're entitled to a property tax exemption. You file late. You can come to the department and say, I was in the hospital. I couldn't have filed. I was out of the country or whatever it happens to be. And then we would make a determination as to whether that hardship was, there was good and sufficient cause for it. And we could grant that hardship and late filing. For these kinds of cases, these are not exemptions. So they don't qualify under that hardship statute. They're what's called a redetermination of value. And so we're just saying these are very, very similar to a late filing exemption. If the person had a difficult time and they were in the hospital, the conditions for those hardships are on the back page of that testimony that I had asked to be handed out. We have an administrative rule that sets out what a hardship is, so it's not just arbitrary and capricious on our part. And that is the sum and substance of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Now, that was House Bill 2230?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Before we go ahead, why don't we have Mary tell us about 2231, and you can talk about that one as well, and then we'll hear from the other two gentlemen.
House Bill 2231 basically allows the county assessor to have the real property assessed after it has been destroyed or damaged. The application may be filed later than the later of August 1st. For 60 days following the date when the property is destroyed or damaged. Under current law, a person only has till August 1st in order to make that application.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. Again, this is very similar to the other bill. It does. The first bill dealt with what if you missed your filing deadline and you have a hardship. This bill deals with extending that deadline to allow you to file timely. And it really focuses in on the people who have a substantial casualty loss in June. Because if you have it in February, you have more than 60 days. But if you have it in June, under current law, you only have till August 1st. So this would allow you 60 days from the date of the casualty loss. And in some cases, under current law, you might only have 31 days. There's always, we look at tax policy as a balance between the fairness of the taxpayer and efficient tax administration. And we've talked with the county assessors, and we said, even though this is a very busy time of the year for them, there's not that many situations that occur late in, you know, in June. And because it is an extreme hardship on the taxpayer, we think this is a more fair way to handle it for them. So I hope that's responsive.
Thank you. I think if it's okay, we'll take questions after we hear from the other two. Go ahead, gentlemen.
Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Richard Kreitzer. I'm the Marion County Assessor and soon to be tax collector. today I'm representing the Oregon Assessors Association. And on House Bill 2230, this is a critical and very difficult time for the taxpayers paying bills on top of their loss from property that they no longer have. this bill will allow the department and us in reviewing each circumstance, and in the case where late filing, where they're ill or incapacitated, we can consider their application even if it's filed late. On House Bill 2231, this bill will give those who have property that is damaged or destroyed at least 60 days to file, as you've heard. This, we believe, is a better balance for the taxpayer and tax administration as we are trying to get work hard to get the assessment roll finalized by September. thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bob. Chairman Barnhart, members of the committee, my name is Bob Vroman. I'm the assessment and tax manager at Clackamas County, and I'm here also on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors, but I think I could speak for the the assessors as well. And these bills both are very straightforward. They deal with people that are suffering situations that aren't normal, and I think call for consideration of maybe some of these extenuating circumstances. We support both the department's ability to take a look at these and determine whether or not they should be referred to the assessor as a hardship, and we certainly support the additional time for them to file an application when they've suffered the kind of losses that occasionally we see. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Butler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First question I had was for John Phillips. John, was there some reason that these had to be two separate bills? They really seem to deal with both the incidence of a hardship and the filing time. Was there a reason why they had to be two bills?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, no, there was no reason. I think we submitted our concepts and they became the bills they did, and I don't know that we had a chat about that.
Okay. Follow up then?
Yes, follow up.
Okay. Thank you very much. I just had one procedural question that I really feel like that I'd like to find out about, and that would be if Oregon suffered in this critical month period sometime after the assessment date, after the January 1st and before the June 30th, and let's make it a June 28th date of a major catastrophic event. What effect would that have? And let's make it a tsunami as to several Oregon coastal counties, or let's make it as to a serious earthquake or a tremor on Mount Hood that created the kind of damage that it could do. What effect would that have then on the counties that would be involved if those events were to occur simultaneously in Oregon? Tell me effect it would have to the assessment offices and then to the taxation of that county, those counties that were involved.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, did you say June 28th, for an example?
Yeah, June 28th, immediately before the, so that you could come under the hardship determination and under the filing deadline extension, so that, I mean, by the time everything got back in order, people could still file under the 60 days.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I'm going to have to think a little bit about that. My first question would be whether or not there was an assessment office. if the office didn't exist or if the bills did not go out on time, then the taxpayers would have an extended time to pay. Just like in 1997 when Measure 50 passed and there was not time to actually get a roll turned and process tax statements, assessors actually sent tax statements late, and that gave taxpayers additional time because of no fault of their own. So my first question would be, well, what would happen if the tax statements went out late? I'm thinking of a bill that passed a couple of sessions ago that gave the director of the Department of Revenue, this was in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, some authority to toll due dates for taxes generally. I'd have to look that up to see if that applies to property taxes. And lastly, I would probably defer to representative from the Assessors Association to see if there's any thoughts they might have.
Well, Chairman Barnhart, I think any catastrophic event like that would put a tremendous burden on any government office. And hopefully that'll never happen, but even at the best case scenario, if this wasn't adopted, January 1 of the following year would be the assessment date for the following tax year, which would be the same scenario.
Thank you. I think that demonstrates the need for an emergency reserve fund at the state level in order to make certain that we have some way of running basic public services. Other questions? If not, thank you very much. Are there other people here who want to testify on House Bill 2230 or House Bill 2231? Don't see any. If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2230 and 2231. And there being no further business for the committee, you get out early today. Congratulations. We are adjourned.
Adjourned.